Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions, even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. That's the sage advice of Founding Father Benjamin Franklin. And it is the focus and essence of this latest from Eastern Standard Education correspondent Cynthia Reeser.
I'm talking to Dr. Nicola Mason today about transformative learning. Dr. Mason is an EKU professor, and she's the chair of the Department of Teaching, Learning, and Educational Leadership. She is a specialist in music education and has been teaching in the education program at EKU for the last 10 years. She's also an advocate for music education in K-12 schools and at the university level, and she's going to discuss with us how transformative learning plays a key role in the classes she teaches. A transformative learning was a theory that first emerged in the 70s, and it was originally conceived for adult learners. But it's very relevant to the K-12 and college classroom and to our daily lives as well. So, Dr. Mason, explain to us exactly what is transformative learning.
Thank you, Dr. Reeser. Well, let me just tell you, I first stumbled upon transformative learning as an approach to learning because I was trying to put a label on these experiences that my students were having in my classes every single semester. So transformative learning is exactly what it sounds like. It's an approach to teaching that facilitates a transformation in the way that we perceive things, the way we feel about things, and then in the actions that we take because of this transformation. So Dr. John Mesereau developed the framework of transformative learning during a study with adult women, as you just said, who were returning to school after a period away from education. He wanted to find out what factors hindered or helped their learning. So there are various stages in transformative learning, but I think the most important components that I'd like to share with you is the critical reflection and critical discourse. Transformative learning has influenced a variety of teaching approaches, teaching and learning approaches. And for those that are clued up on educational approaches, it's very much aligned with constructivist education. But two components that I really want to stress in terms of transformative learning is a Mesereau belief that people can change their points of view by trying on another's point of view. And that by learning new frames of reference, one could transform habits of mind.
So tell us some examples. Help us imagine what this looks like and give us some examples from your classroom.
I've got quite a few, but I'll share at least one or two with you. So I teach a class called Exploring Africa Through Play. It's a class that I developed several years ago based on my original research. It's a general education elective course. So any student from any major can take this class. And what we do is we explore the diversity of Africa through the lens of children's songs and games. I was really, the premise of the course was out of my frustration with a lot of my students stereotyping Africa. I was shocked how many students think that Africa is a single country, that it's still very primitive in nature, or that everyone in Africa has dark skin. Of course, this is based on my own experiences being a South African American immigrant and having students be very surprised when they hear that I was educated and grew up in South Africa, but that I have light skin. Africa is a really diverse continent with 54 different countries, each as unique as the next. We spend a lot of class time sitting in circles playing different games in different languages, using materials that are unique to different geographical regions. I don't know if you know that there are over 2,000 African languages spoken on the continent. We use different complex rhythms, but we're essentially looking at the diversity of Africa through this lens of children's songs and games. While we do this, we reflect on the origins of our own Western games based on the historical use of traditional African games. So, for example, there's a game called Cheche Kule. It's an East African game, and it's a simple call and response. So there's a leader, and they call something, and then the group responds, usually with an exact imitation. But it's strikingly similar to head, shoulders, knees, and toes. Now, I don't know which one came first, the chicken or the egg, but we do know that eastern parts of Africa are known as the cradle of humanity because of the oldest human remains have been found there. And we also know that some of the oldest board games, like Mancala, have their roots in East Africa. So this critical analysis and reflections helps to broaden students' views of Africa from perhaps maybe the primitive idea that they have to a far more complex and influential culture that is the African continent. While we're doing this reflection, students usually gravitate to a much deeper critical thinking that explores their own personal misconceptions of Africa. And we address a lot of those stereotypes, but more importantly, we address the questions of why, underlining influences that have led us to those stereotypes. So my goal with this class especially is to create a new frame of reference about Africa because we've challenged students' assumptions and beliefs through critical reflection and dialogue. And that's really the primary principle of a transformative learning.
So it sounds like your students come in with one conception and they transform and have a much deeper and more nuanced understanding at the end of the class. So that's transformative learning, right?
That's it, in a nutshell. Pretty straightforward, yeah.
And what was your other example?
So I have another example from my Culturally Responsive Perspectives class. This is a class required by all our elementary and middle grades education majors. So those that want to teach kindergarten through fifth grade or fifth grade through ninth grade. And I really refer to this as the light bulb moment class. One of the many topics that we discuss in this class is privilege and the opportunities afforded to those with various types of privileges. Now, privilege is a heavy topic. So we start small and we discuss everyday privileges like right-handedness. Dr. Risa, are you left or right-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Right. So you represent 90% of the world's population because only 10% of the world's population is left-handed. But I don't know if you've realized most everyday items are designed for right-handed people. So if I think about musical instruments, for example, guitars, sports equipment like golf clubs, everyday items like scissors, even cultural practices or social practices like shaking hands are really focused on right-handed people. When we open this discussion up in class, it's quite illuminating to right-handed students when they hear what left-handed students have to go through on a daily basis to adapt their left-handed predominance in a right-handed world, essentially. And then we dig a little deeper into privilege as well. We talk about gender privileges, so those privileges afforded to males or females in different countries. And we talk about ethnic and racial privileges as well. Many of our students, and I'd say many adults probably, have never really thought about the privileges that they are afforded on a daily basis. And that really is the definition of privilege. If you don't have to think about it, it's a privilege. But the purpose of this activity in class is really self-examination and reflection. It's not to shame anyone, because it's not our fault that we have privilege. We didn't ask for any of these privileges. I didn't ask to be right-handed. But what we want students to do is reflect on what they intend to do with their privilege once they recognize they have it. Recognizing various privileges allows us to view the world in a different way, and we stop making assumptions about others. And because we're preparing future educators, we recognize different privileges and how that can help us be a better teacher.
Of course, a lot of our listeners aren't students, or they're not teachers, or they're not public educators. So how can we make that jump and apply transformative learning to our everyday, regular, daily lives?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it reminded me of a story that you told me recently. Do you want to share that story with us?
I did. When I was a child in the 70s, I went shopping with my grandmother, and we went to a ritzy furniture store in a nearby town, and she asked to see the bedroom set. She wanted to buy a new bedroom set, and the salesman made an assumption, and I've never been quite sure what he based it on, but he took her to the very back, to the very cheapest part, the bargain bin. And she was so insulted by that because, she had the money. She was going to pay the man cash that we left that store. And that made such an impression on me. I think we could describe it as a transformative experience because it dawned on me for the first time how people judge us on our appearance, or something about her dialect, something about the way she looked made that person assume something about her that was completely wrong.
Right, exactly. And so that self-reflection is such a key part of transformative learning. And then I'd venture to say the next step was putting that reflection into action and how that impacted the way you interact with other people, perhaps.
And I like to think so. I like to think that as they say, don't judge a book by its cover. But, you know, we all fall into that trap sometimes. We all misjudge or assume things that aren't the case.
Exactly.
Can you think of any examples that you've witnessed or examples maybe that your students have shared that have been just really insightful about how it can work in our daily life?
Yeah, I had a student a few years ago that brought a poem to class. They had to do exactly that. They had to bring an example of something that changed their point of reference or changed their point of view. And there's a poem by Joshua Dickinson. It's called "'Cause I Ain't Got a Pencil." And if you don't mind, I might read it to you. It's just a short poem.
Yes.
I woke myself up because we ain't got an alarm clock. Dug in the dirty clothes basket because ain't nobody washed my uniform. Brushed my hair and teeth in the dark because the lights ain't on. Even got my baby sister ready because my mama wasn't home. Got us both to school on time to eat us a good breakfast. Then, when I got to class, the teacher fussed because I ain't got a pencil. I can visibly see the paradigm shift that happens with students when they read this poem, and we've been reading it every semester since. And it really aligns with what Ms. Rowe stated, that transformative learning is when a new frame of reference transforms our habits of mind. And it really gets students thinking about their students, or it gets my students thinking about their own students and the situations that brought them to their classes every day and some of the challenges that they have just to make it to class every single day to learn.
Hopefully, people can think about those assumptions and apply that idea, this educational theory of transformative learning, in the way they see others. Thank you so much for being with us today. This has been Dr. Nicola Mason, the chair of the Department of Teaching, Learning, and Educational Leadership at EKU. So thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
The more you know.
It's fun and it's really interesting to discover things that you didn't know about the world around you, including how the past informs the present and the future. For instance, what do you know about the Warrior's Path?
The Warrior's Path was probably the nation's first north-south interstate highway.
Max Hammond, executive director of the Warrior's Path Project, a group working to document and map this ancient north-south byway.
The path once stretched all the way from the Gulf of Mexico to the Great Lakes. And on its way, it passed through the heart of Kentucky, which at that time was the epicenter of trade amongst all the diverse people of North America.
The Warrior's Path Project got its start as a vision of folks in McKee and Olive Hill, both certified Kentucky trail towns. It has been selected as a project for the National Park Service's Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. The plan is to develop one of the largest connected trail systems in the region next to the Appalachian Trail. As you'll see on the map on our homepage at esweku.org, the path winds its way through the Cumberland Gap to the Ohio River. So, Max Hammond, what's your goal?
We're supported by the National Park Service. They have a Rivers, Trail, and Conservation Program where they give us expert advice and counsel and the resources necessary to make the connections to eventually reestablish this path. And we hope to do so to serve as a stimulus not only to appreciate and preserve our wildlands, but to stimulate the economy. Our hope is, Tom, that all these small, isolated mountain towns along the path will be able to show the treasures that they have, the treasures that are unique to their community, and bring outside visitors into eastern Kentucky to enjoy what we have known all along is here, our natural beauty and our people. But one of the most important objectives of this is to teach everyone the lesson that Native Americans have always lived in Kentucky. They were the first Kentuckians. They were the first Appalachians. And we don't want them to any longer be the forgotten Appalachians.
What are we talking about here? A literal, actual path or trail?
So as far as us finding a trail in some isolated wooded spot that we can positively identify as the warrior's path, we may never do that, but we probably will find some spots that could have been the warrior's path that are marked in particular ways, or rock faces eroded by human passage, or horses, or elk, or mastodon that actually originally made this path. So we think we're going to be pretty accurate about where it goes through ground truthing, through LIDAR, through different types of topographical investigation. We think we can pinpoint where it's at and be able to tell the complete and true history of Kentucky, to be able to tell 12,000 years of history of Kentucky.
Well, there were villages throughout the area, and in one case, there was something of a town that, and I hope I don't butcher its name, but I'm going to give it a try, the village of Iskipakatiki. Is that, am I close?
You did well. And that could actually be the root word that Kentucky came from. Yeah, that was a major village.
It was in what is now Clark County, is that right?
That's correct. There's a plain. It's a very flat area just south of Winchester, and that was probably a very large village at one time, and the Warrior's Path passed through there and actually forked and went a couple of different directions from there, one toward Maysville and the other toward Greenup County in Kentucky.
Hammond is working with EKU sociology major Brian Caldwell, recent graduate Maura Rem, and sociology professor Stephanie McSpirit. You and your students have been creating this interactive map of the Warrior's Path, and I'm curious about that. How are you doing this? Are you using any kind of technology that is used in mapping today, or is it, as Max said, you're pulling together historical maps?
Well, that's one of the opportunities that the Warrior's Path and the Eastern Kentucky University Partnership could provide in terms of getting students out into the field, doing a lot of this ground truthing and mapping and identifying historical sites and working with local communities and local archaeology programs in order to document and catalog and tell the story of a lot of these places. One of the things we're using is Survey 123 and story mapping through the license we have at Eastern Kentucky University in order to train students in those technologies.
The Warrior's Path Project is a hands-on, fascinating learning experience for students. But as Max Hammond sees it, it's something more.
It's one of the most important things that we can get from the Warrior's Path is the recognition that this was a homeland before the Europeans called it a homeland.
So who are we talking about?
The Shawnee, the Cherokee, the Wyandot, the Delaware, the Cree, and some, please forgive me if you all were listening that I forgot to mention, but there are so many tribes that were tied to Kentucky, and we're going to dispel the fallacy that Kentucky was nothing more than a hunting ground.
Right. Yeah. Expand on that a little bit, because that is a popular myth.
It is a popular myth, and we trace that myth back to the first land developers in Kentucky. It was much easier to sell real estate, and it was much easier to put a legal claim against real estate if you said nobody ever lived there, that nobody had a right to the land before you did. So they started the story that Native Americans never lived here. It was a lie.
Professor McSpirit.
as a sociology professor, one of the things that I'd like to see with the Warrior's Path and the partnership with EKU is to get university students back in their home counties, talking with local people about the local history and getting them involved in recording those stories, as well as then interpreting those stories and working in the local cultural centers.
Earlier, Max Hammond mentioned the aim of helping isolated mountain communities in eastern Kentucky make something of the stories that have been passed down through generations. That really appeals to EKU sociology major Brian Caldwell.
I'm going to talk about something Judy Schmidt, one of the co-chairs of the Warrior's Path Project, told us about on our tour down in Jackson County. And it's this local legend they have in the county about Captain Swift's lost silver. So Captain Swift allegedly discovered some silver deposits in the area and mined them and made a killing, and then only to be sent off to the Revolutionary War and come back and never be able to find it again. So there are these tales of Swift's lost silver, and every once in a while people will claim to have found some silver in the area, and it just keeps going like that.
And so this story kind of emerged from this project, from the
She was... We took a tour of the Warrior's Path Project, and one of our stops was in Jackson County. And it's just this great local legend that they have. And I was, I loved to experience some part of the local culture that almost never gets seen.
Hammond and McSpirit are working with the Kentucky Native American Heritage Commission to verify the accuracy of their findings.
We're working with them, and of course, we're working with EKU and potentially other universities too that will do ground truthing and oral histories. But the way we came up with the route for the trail is we have established known points that were on the Warrior's Path and taken maps that were perhaps created in the 1700s, Tom, and compiled those maps with current maps and these known sites to come up with what we believe to be a fairly accurate historical route of where the Warrior's Path was.
What Hammond sees in this project is something we've talked about, complained about really, for years and years.
It's an opportunity for us to finally tell our own story. We haven't really done a great job doing that so far. We've let other people tell our stories. But now, through the Warrior's Path, we're going to get to tell our story.
Communities certified as Kentucky Trail Towns, and there are six of them located along or very near the Warrior's Path, provide supplies, guides, lodging, food, and hospitality to hikers. It's hoped that the redeveloped trail will soon support and stimulate those local economies, while also deepening our understanding of the Native American cultures and societies that existed and thrived in the area for millennia. Coming up after the break, working from home. Is the genie out of the bottle?
Most people have become accustomed to working, at least in some sort of a hybrid arrangement, and they're not going to give that up without a fight.
The argument for putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions.
We're incentivizing pollution by not making polluters pay for their damages.
And encouraging live theater production in Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
WEKU is supported by Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, who believe that strong communities share strong values. That's why co-ops are proud to support Special Olympics Kentucky for the past 10 years. That's the power of human connection.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
The number of people working from home had been slowly increasing for years, but the pandemic really accelerated the trend. Some believe the genie is now out of the bottle. Javier David, managing editor for business and markets at Axios, looked into the question and joins us from New York. Welcome, Javier.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And so I think a good place to start is with the first sentence of your article, which says the work from home revolution
grudgingly embraced by corporate America, has evolved into a thing that workers both love and hate. What have you found?
What we have here are a couple of top-level arguments in favor of working from home. For the workers, anyway, it's very convenient. There is time that's saved in commuting. You get to spend more time with your family if you have one, or friends. The ability to work from literally anywhere. It can be your favorite coffee shop, restaurant. You can do sort of working vacations where you go out of town and work from a hotel or somewhere else. You can juggle errands with everyday work without having to take time off. If you are nervous about getting infected with COVID, which is kind of the meta narrative here, you can stay home. And if you live in a big city where crime, unfortunately, has been on the rise, you can avoid getting on public transportation. But there are some real trade-offs with that. There are, for knowledge workers like myself, longer hours and a sort of meeting fatigue, which has been flagged by a number of researchers. The unscheduled interactions that usually happen in the office kind of spontaneously, effectively become formal invitations to an appointment or a call. And my preferred term for that is kind of the tyranny of the calendar invite. You're spending a lot more money at home expenses in terms of utilities or bills that may or may not be fully reimbursed. There are some distractions at home and working in your remote office of choice, background noise, spotty internet, things that you cannot necessarily control and can't, you know, call on tech support to address. A lot of people, myself included, tend to log in during off hours, and then there's this expectation that responses to inquiries will be immediate or that you're at least immediately available. And then for the employer, there are some sunk costs associated with maintaining expensive office buildings and associated employee office perks. So the prestige, if you think about it, of the office tower, the company headquarters, is diminished if basically nobody's filling those buildings regularly.
What does the data tell you about productivity?
The interesting thing is they've done some research on this, and there is, on average, I think there was a very well-flagged study that published in Nature based on some observations that they did with the teams at Microsoft, which I think the control group there was like over 60,000 workers. They found that people became less interconnected. A University of Chicago study actually found that if you had some employees, with children at home, actually had more longer work days and a larger decline in productivity than those without children. And then women specifically found that they had a larger decline in productivity, but those with longer hour company tenure actually managed to fare better.
What about the economics of all this, the impact on service sector businesses and other small businesses?
Yeah, you know, there's a very noticeable effect, second-order economic effect. There's a decline in activity in certain business districts. If you think about it, office workers go out for coffee, they go out for lunch, they may sort of do window shopping or whatever on their way home or, again, on their lunch break. All of that is lost if the worker is sort of concentrated in residential areas or working from home. Those neighborhoods did a little bit of a trade-off because they people will go to their favorite coffee shop in their neighborhood or go shopping in their neighborhood. So the local business may thrive, but certainly office districts or business districts where that activity used to be centered has seen a noticeable decline in activity, and that translates into fewer jobs.
Fortune magazine is looking at data that found about 3 out of 5 managers think that remote work is on the wane and workers will be back in the office full time by the end of this year. Is that wishful thinking on the part of these managers, or is that trend reversing?
I think it's wishful thinking for now. I think that most managers, given the fact that, you know, I want to state from the outset, catching COVID in 2022 is far different from catching COVID in 2020. And I think most employers recognize that with the advent of vaccines and treatments, there's a way to manage it and sort of live on our terms as opposed to living on the virus's terms. So I think that many managers who were sort of reluctantly dragged into the hybrid work environment, some did it more willingly than others. But the bottom line is there is a belief that, okay, it's not the same as it was. We're no longer really in the emergency phase. Let's try and see how best we can get workers back into the office. But the flip side of that is most people have become accustomed to working, at least in some sort of a hybrid arrangement, and they're not going to give that up without a fight. And some people, a lot of polls have cited workers stating specifically that if they did not have the ability to work remotely or on a hybrid basis, they'd find another job. And as you've seen, there's been a tremendous amount of turnover in jobs because people are, you know, leaving jobs for a host of different reasons. But workers have a tremendous amount of power that they've been able to recoup during the pandemic era, and they're not going to necessarily give that up without some sort of a fight.
You close your article by suggesting that some bosses may soon decide that work from home just isn't worth the compromise or the strains on their relationships with their workers. But the reason this has happened in the first place, COVID, is still very much around and appears to be actually surging again. Is that likely to slow any major return to the office full time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that employers are going to be very, very deliberate and very considered in their judgments with respect to return to office when Omicron surged late fall, early in the winter. You saw a number of people put their return to office plans on hold because they realized, okay, you know, with numbers creeping up, it's definitely harder to do. So the more that we have these sort of waves of COVID infections, the more you will see employers pull back or at least ease up on the pedal and not pressure their employees to come in. But again, as I stated, it's different in 2022 with vaccinations and treatments and the fact that the variants that are circulating, at least for now, are not on the level as the original virus. Mm-hmm. There's going to be at least some acknowledgement of that from employers and a little bit of more ability for them to kind of lure people back into the office. And some of that will involve some incentives or perks, like, hey, like, let's have free lunch or bagels on Friday or something of that nature that will be at least some sort of bait for employees to feel a little bit more comfortable coming back in.
Javier David, Managing Editor for Business and Markets at Axios. Thank you so much, Javier.
Thank you.
Could something called fee and dividend move us along in what looks to be a race against the clock to reduce the impacts of climate change? John Clark, Appalachia Regional Coordinator for the Citizens Climate Lobby, thinks it can. He's on the line with us from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Okay, let's talk about fee and dividend. Is this concept really the same as a carbon tax?
Yes, basically. You can think of fee and dividend as kind of a three-legged stool. The carbon tax part of it would be a tax on pollution at the source. That would be the mine, the wellhead, or the port of entry where fossil fuels are imported into our economy. It would be starting at a low price so we don't shock our economy, about $15 per ton of CO2 emissions. And then it would be steadily rising every year as a way to reduce emissions. That second leg of the stool would be the dividend part. We don't want to address this problem on the backs of low and middle income earners. So we want to return that revenue back to American citizens equally as a way to kind of incentivize people to reduce their impact, reduce their carbon footprint, and keep more of that dividend check in their pockets. And then the third leg of the stool would be what's called a border tax adjustment. And this is being talked about right now in Washington. So basically we want to put a tax on any imports coming from any countries without a carbon price in place to level the playing field. We don't want to incentivize our American manufacturers to move overseas into places where it's free to pollute, like China or India. So we want to level the playing field.
So this is kind of economics version of behavior modification.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a free market solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. I've always been kind of a fiscal conservative. I love the free market approach to this problem, you know, putting the market to work. Right now, our system's set up, we're incentivizing pollution by not making polluters pay for their damages. And we're actually subsidizing fossil fuels. So
We want to put the market to work and kind of reversing that.
Well, last summer, John, we got the news from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that even if nations started cutting greenhouse emissions right now, global temperatures will almost surely still rise by 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's the limit at which, according to the report, runaway climate change will begin to upend life as we know it, as they put it. So the imperative is there. How would the fee and dividend concept help pull us back from that outcome?
Yeah, we're at about 1.1 degrees Celsius right now, temperature rise. And as you mentioned, we need to limit it to 1.5, do everything possible we can. And economists say that the single most impactful thing we can do to quickly and drastically reduce emissions is put a price on carbon. And that we don't see that as a silver bullet approach. We need a lot of different things, kind of a silver buckshot approach. So we need a lot of solutions, but the main one that we really need to do quickly is start to price carbon pollution. It's not free to pollute. We should have been addressing this decades ago when Dr. James Hansen first addressed climate change to Congress back in the 80s. But we've been stalling on this issue. And not to say we haven't done anything. We've done a lot through regulations. We've reduced pollution here in the U.S., but we need to do a lot more. The three biggest polluters in the world are China, the U.S., and India currently.
You mentioned that there is discussion underway in Washington right now about the border tax adjustment. And I'm just wondering, in your view, has congressional action to address climate change aligned with this sense of urgency that's being expressed by climate scientists?
Not at all. No, we're pretty far behind with getting serious about addressing this. CCL has been advocating for fee and dividend for a decade now. We do have a bill in Congress right now, the Energy Innovation Carbon Dividend Act, which has 96 co-sponsors in the House, all of them currently Democrats. We've had bipartisan support in the past, but we absolutely need more Republicans to get on board with this.
And there must be a sense of urgency behind that, I would imagine, because we're looking at the possibility, the seeming likelihood of a sea change in terms of majorities and minorities on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's really imperative for representatives who represent like coal communities to get them on board with, and come to the table with solutions. I feel like this problem is being addressed by outside entities from coal communities in ways that aren't helpful to coal communities. And, you know, we have things like clean energy mandates or divestment campaigns or campaigns to shut down coal-fired power plants and even banning coal exports from our ports, which is all effective at reducing emissions, but it's not helpful to coal communities. So we need representatives in coal communities to come to the table and start talking about climate change solutions.
And I take it that generally has not been happening.
Correct. Yeah. We're starting to see some movement on things like carbon capture and sequestration technology, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, which is great. There's been some movement on through agriculture, which is good, but we definitely need to be talking about carbon pricing to quickly reduce emissions where we need to be.
Well, to make it real for everybody, in your estimation, you've been following this for a decade now. How much time do we have to make the necessary changes before we really do begin to see even heavier impacts than what we're already experiencing now?
I don't think it's ever too late to really have an impact. If we pass 1.5 degrees Celsius, you know, if we limit it to 1.7, that's still better than living in a 1.9 degrees Celsius warming world, which is better than living in a 2.1 degrees Celsius warming world, that kind of thing. So it's never too late to really get serious about this, but we are definitely seeing impacts now. Some of the impacts that I've seen in Kentucky, we just did CCL just did a tour across Kentucky and Tennessee. I toured some damaged areas from the tornadoes that ripped through in December. And, mm-hmm. you know, just seeing that devastation, it's one of the things that climate scientists are saying is Tornado Alley is shifting to the south and to the east, which is absolutely in the crosshairs of Kentucky.
All right, that's John Clark, Appalachia Regional Coordinator for the Citizens Climate Lobby. You can find it online. Just Google Citizens Climate Lobby. He's on with us from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Theatrical stage production is very much alive across the Commonwealth as we hear from Bill McCann and his guests in this latest in our series on theater in Kentucky.
My guest today is Brian Walker, a playwright from Louisville and the Dramatists Guild representative for the state of Kentucky. After college, Brian went to L.A. with the idea of becoming an actor, but he returned to Louisville in 2004 with a different goal in mind, to become a playwright. And that second theatrical goal achieved results pretty quickly. In 2006, he founded Finnegan Productions, and more recently, Derby City Playwrights. And across almost the two decades since Brian returned to Kentucky, he has found success as a producer, director, and a two-time winner of the Kentucky Theater Association's Roots of the Bluegrass New Play Festival. Currently, Brian is in the middle of his term as Dramatist Guild Rep for Kentucky. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Brian Walker.
Oh, thank you, Bill. Thank you so much for having me and for that introduction. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. So let's start today, Brian, by first briefly discussing the Dramatists Guild, who's eligible to belong, what the organization does for its members. Before we turn to you as the organization's representative in Kentucky and what you want to do to encourage and develop playwrights and theaters here in Kentucky.
Sure. Yeah. The Dramatists Guild is a national trade organization that's dedicated to playwrights, composers, lyricists, librettists. And their main goal is to aid dramatists in protecting both their artistic and economic integrity of their work. It's open to anyone. If you have written a play, you can become an associate member. And then once you've had a play produced, you can become a full member of the Dramatists Guild.
And what's the difference between a guild and a union? Why a Dramatists Guild?
Well, the guild... Playwrights do not have a common boss, if you will. Playwrights do not report to one entity. We are independent contractors. So the guild is not a union because it does not try to fight for higher wages for playwrights, collective bargaining, or anything like that. The guild is really focused and dedicated on making sure that playwrights' work is protected and that playwrights' wishes are honored when their plays are being produced.
So when you mean protected, what, copyright or something else? What are you talking about?
Copyright. One of the main things about being in the Dramatists Guild is contracts. When you have a play produced, you have a contract with that theater. The Dramatists Guild will not only vet contracts for you, but they actually have a database of contracts that you can utilize to make sure that your rights as a playwright are being honored. Things like having your name featured with the title of your play, things like making sure the integrity of your work is intact, meaning a play cannot change your dialogue, a play cannot change the title of your play, different protections like that.
Okay. You were elected as the Guild's rep in 2020 for a three-year term, about the time that COVID took off and Broadway was closing down. It's a pretty bleak time for the arts generally and particularly for theaters. So what were you able to do for your members during that period, or were you able to do anything at all?
Yeah, minimal. The whole Dramatists Guild took all of their programming online and encouraged reps to not really do anything in person for really the last 2 years. So I was able to hold 5 online events. I had a meetup where I sort of introduced myself to Kentucky Dramatists Guild members. And then I hosted 4 Footlight events, which are Dramatists Guild hosted readings of full-length plays where the playwright has the opportunity to get feedback on their work after the reading. So those were all online, and we were able to do 4 different ones. 4 different playwrights around the state were able to have readings of their work. But now that we are sort of moving through this a bit, I've got my eye on the future and what we can potentially do. And I really would like to focus this next calendar year on playwrights that are having their work produced in the state of Kentucky and trying to form some community around the productions, trying to invite members when a member has a play that's being produced in the state, putting a call out to all of our Kentucky members and having just an informal social meetup before the show and then being there afterwards for the playwright to offer feedback on their work. My third year, I am really hoping to host some sort of panels and town halls about new play production, producing your own work, and things like that. But I don't think I'll focus on that until we get into 2023.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on how you would like to interact with theaters, with playwrights who perhaps aren't members of a guild yet, but maybe should be joining or thinking about joining?
Well, you know, contests are a great way to develop new plays and new playwrights. They're, you know, give playwrights the opportunity to get some confidence in the work. And I have advised a theater already in the state of Kentucky on having a new play contest and working through submission guidelines and what's appropriate to ask for and what's not in a new play contest. So my hope is over the next year, I'd like to make as many contacts with Kentucky theaters as I can and offer my services to help with any sort of new play contest that they may want to have, whether it's something specific for their region, you know, a Kentucky-centric play, or if they just want to put a call out for new plays. You know, there's a lot that goes into it, and I've certainly been a lot of experience over the years in doing contests. The Dramatists Guild is not an entity that would host a contest. It's sort of antithetical to the mission of the organization to pit playwrights against each other. But what I would love to do is be able to, you know, be counsel for theaters that are looking to do this and just don't know, you know, where to start.
As you're talking about play contests, are you aware that Eastern Standard is conducting its own play contest?
Yes, it's a radio play contest, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I think that's very cool.
Can you give our listeners some advice, perhaps, if they want to venture into this new field of writing radio plays? What do you recommend that they do?
Yeah, I mean, they've been around forever. I mean, radio plays have been around for longer than television. And I think the key thing to a radio play is making sure that you understand that the audience cannot see what is happening, and that sound plays a huge part in a radio play, and making sure that if you are putting together a script that you are hoping to be presented on the radio, you need to make sure that you're focusing on sounds, not just, you know, characters coming and going, but, you know, what you would think of as sound effects for things like a phone ringing or a paper being torn up. Sound is a great way in a radio play to move your narrative forward.
Right, to create a theater of the mind.
Exactly, theater of the mind. That's a great way to put it.
As a playwright, you've written some plays that have been produced, of course, but recently you had your play Dog published. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was about 8 years in the making. I've been working on that baby for a long time. That was my first Roots of the Bluegrass win. Kathy E.B. Ellis directed the reading, which you were actually a part of that reading.
I was.
At the Kentucky Theater Association's conference that year. So that was sort of my first opportunity to hear it out loud and to get feedback from folks that were there and to also just gain a bit of confidence in the work, realizing, okay, if this play won this contest, maybe I should send it out. So I sent it out and I got another bite about another year and a half, 2 years after that. Theater in Sacramento included it in their New Works Festival. Capital Stage is the name of that theater. And they had a development of the play, and I was given feedback and even presented with I wasn't able to go out there for it, but they sent me a DVD of the reading with feedback from all of the actors. So I worked all that feedback into the script and started sending it out again. And then during COVID, a lot of theaters were looking for content online. And the Cincinnati Lab Theater in Cincinnati, it's a great new play development theater. They did an online production of my play. Again, really got to dig into it and get a lot of great feedback. And then I sent it out to publishers. And I sent it out to many publishers. And Broadway Play Publishing is in New York City. And they bit. Yeah, it's I'm excited about it, but it's been a, you know, it's been a long time coming. You know, as a playwright yourself, you work on something, you send it out, you hope for a bite. And this was just something that I just didn't give up on it. I didn't put it in the drawer and put it away. I just kept sending it. And I'll tell you what, I have more rejection letters from this play than I have any other play that I've written. But I still kept sending it out. And now it's sitting on the bookshelf at the dramatist bookshop in New York City.
Wow. So what kept you sending it out if you were getting all these rejections? Why not just move on to something else?
I believed in it. I knew it was a good story. And I knew that the artists that had been involved in the different iterations of it believed that it was a good story, too. And I think as a playwright, we have to remember that theaters are looking for very specific things. You may have a fantastic play, but if you don't have a part for a 65-year-old woman who is possibly the head of the board of this theater, your play is not going to be accepted. And so you've got to take rejections in stride. You've got to realize that these rejections are not necessarily speaking to the content of your play. They're speaking to the producibility of your play by that specific theater. And when you think about it like that, see, you want to send it out to everywhere. You want to send it to every person because you know somewhere, somebody loves dogs and wants to produce a play about one.
What's the play about? I guess I should have asked that first.
The play is about a woman who loses her dog. She's a single woman, no kids. And those of us that are in that boat, we all know how important our animals are to us. They're like our kids. And she has a relationship like that with her dog. And her dog gets away from her and she searches for her dog for a year. And then she happens upon a couple in a park and they're walking her dog and she attacks them and tries to get her dog back. And that's where the play starts, is after she's attacked these people who she is convinced is now in possession of their dog. And the play is sort of about these people coming together and figuring out what is the right answer in regards to this living creature that now not only is she in love with this animal, but the couple that have adopted the dog after it got away from her, that they have also fallen in love with this animal. So it's a love story basically to our four-legged companions.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Congratulations on your publication. Appreciate your work for theater here in Kentucky. Today, my guest has been Brian Walker, the Dramatists Guild representative for Kentucky. And thank you very much for being on Eastern Standard today, Brian.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for all of the work that you do for Kentucky playwrights. Thank you so much.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgerald-Dean, studio dog. Thanks to Tower of Power for The More You Know, The More You Know You Don't Know. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.